Counsel, whenever you're ready. The next matter is In Re Interest of Preston O.
Is it Preston and Portia?
Yes.
Okay. May it please the court, my name is Joel Jay. I'm from Chapel. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, who is the mother of this action, which was brought on a termination of her parental rights. I think I'll start off here with what's, I think, is probably my weakest argument, but I'm going to still throw it out there, and that has to do with that out-of-home placement. The statute strictly exactly reads out-of-home placement for a period of time. At the time of this termination, the children had moved back into their biological or, depending on which child, their stepfather's home. My client was in there for a period of time and then moved out. And so I think there's a question as far as the time period, as far as what out-of-home placement means. I think what it means is whether or not, granted the state might have care, custody, and control, but out-of-home placement, I think, would mean out of home, because that's what it says, the law says, and so then they would be with in some sort of foster placement. That's one of my arguments. Another argument that I would make involves the reasonable efforts, and on this, I think I'm afraid I'm going to have to be rather critical of the department. I mean, I know that's the nature of it, but they went through a series of caseworkers. If you reviewed the materials, they had three separate caseworkers involved in this. The period of time that the caseworkers actually met and reviewed the issues with the mother, visitor with the mother, supervisor with the mother, are a small period of time. The first caseworker was present with the mother only a couple times. The second one was never present for mealtime, which was a big issue throughout this case. Or discipline, only saw them at team meetings, which is a large group meeting. That's the only time that they saw them, and she did not have the mother's address. Also, as far as whether or not reasonable efforts were made, that second caseworker who was on it the longest stated that she never specifically reviewed any goals with the mother as far as what she was supposed to do. The third caseworker who was on it for the last 5 months only was present for two visits, which came up to a total of about 30 to 40 minutes total that she is there. There was a family support worker that spent hundreds of hours and many time with it. The family support worker, and this also goes, this goes more to the best interest argument that I would make. The family support worker specifically stated that did not believe, she says, I'm not sure it'd be the best interest of the children to take that away, meaning that their time with their mother, and she had spent much time with them. She had seen the kids interact, knew how they interacted with their mother. And so regarding the best interest, the only person who spent hundreds of hours, who spent the majority of the time, who really knew these people, could say that she wasn't sure it was in the best interest. The other caseworkers who would testify to that, what they had to say was they believed that it was, but their argument was based on a limited amount of time. If you added up all three caseworkers together, they spent less than a dozen meetings with them, very few that were with just the mother and the children, when they came up to this conclusion that it was in the best interest to terminate. And I believe, you know, the law is going to tell us that if we're going to go forward with a termination action, that it should be in the absence of any reasonable alternative in the last resort. And the way things stood at the time of the hearing, these children were living with the only father that they had known. He was a stepfather to the older child and a biological father to the younger child. And so they were in a placement, a permanent placement. There was a reasonable alternative to the termination of the mother's rights. The trial court in this case can act for a permanent custody hearing, could set down certain guidelines if there were worries as regarding the mother spending unsupervised time. That could have been set up. And so there were reasonable alternatives to whether or not there had to have this termination take place. The kids were living in a safe home. That's where they were at. They weren't moved out of it. They were with their father. The mother just wasn't there. She was in living someplace else. And she would see them with these family support. That sort of thing could have carried on. The kids wouldn't have been in any danger. And in fact, the family support worker said, you know, it is in these kids' best interest. They have such a strong bond, is what she said, with these kids, that it would be terrible to see that thing, that bond, broken. And so I don't think that we can look at the full record and say that it was in the best interest of the kids, that there wasn't reasonable alternatives, that this had to be the last resort, because it doesn't seem like it was.
Counsel, just so that I'm clear on one issue. My understanding was that there was an evaluation of your client that she was found to be unable to take care of these children on a regular basis?
There were a couple of evaluations done.
Well, but there was one initially.
And then there was an initial evaluation that was done early on in the case because there was a question as to competency.
Right.
And that one was done. Later, there were evaluations regarding parenting done by two different mental health experts.
One earlier and one later.
Yes, and by a period of a few months.
And basically not much had changed, as I recall.
There were some changes in her medication, but whether or not they could make a determination about her successfully parenting, there wasn't much of an argument between the two, you know, as to parenting issues. My argument with those mental health professionals is none of them have ever met the children, didn't observe the children, you know, whether or not they would make an argument of her parenting abilities. They didn't witness anything like that.
But if they're telling us that the testimony is that they did not feel she was capable of parenting these children, how long do you think these children should remain in limbo until she's able to properly care for these kids?
I know that's one of the arguments or the issues that comes up, that we can't leave kids hanging out there forever, but they weren't. They're with their father. And there could have been a custody order that says they're placed with their father and their mother lives someplace else and their mother visits. The kids aren't in limbo. I know where they are right now. Actually, they live about 2 blocks from my office. They're not in limbo. They're at the same place they have been for about 2.5 years. And so it's not in limbo in the same sense as we have children out of their parents' home living in foster care and then they move to another foster parent. These kids are in a permanent home. They're not in limbo. The only issue is whether or not they'd go back and live with their mother. You know, and there's dissolution cases that involve child custody that the kids don't live, the kids can't live with both parents. And those kids aren't in limbo. We don't act like they're in limbo because they live with one parent and not the other parent. But your line of questioning also leads into the other issue that I know that the state will address, and that is that apparently with all the attorneys involved in the trial court, we did not address the issue under the 292.01. My client, with her competency, had an issue, and that statute was addressed, never received a guardian ad litem appointed, and the law is pretty clear that says the court shall appoint a guardian ad litem for the incompetent person in the termination under that section of the statute, which is what they went forward, and there wasn't one appointed, and I can't explain to you why they weren't. You know, there was questions about the competency that were raised up throughout the course of it, and under the research that I did, I could find that there were issues where the guardian ad litem, the courts decided that we didn't need to have a guardian ad litem appointed at adjudication hearing, but it's pretty clear that at a termination hearing under this section of the statute, there has to be a guardian ad litem for the parent appointed, and we didn't have one, and it was definitely an issue that came up about her competency that we continued to address.
Was there a determination by the court that she was incompetent at any point in time?
There were probably a total of 4 evaluations, and I do not believe that we ever found that she was incompetent to understand the nature of what the proceedings were. The very first proceeding at their advisement of rights, when asked if she understood, she said she couldn't understand anything and didn't understand a lot of the words. A lot of effort was made to try to make sure she could understand the different parts of the proceedings. There wasn't a strict incompetency finding that she wasn't competent.
And the petition for termination was filed under sections 5, 6, and 7?
I believe so.
43-292?
I believe so.
And which one do you think this applies to?
I believe it's 5.
Okay.
And I think the statute reads that under subsection 5 of that, court shall appoint guardian ad litem for the alleged incompetent parent. Doesn't say that we have to find the parent incompetent. Do you have any other questions?
No questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. And please, the court, good afternoon. My name is Douglas Pollack, and I'm the dual county attorney who initiated this matter.
Can we start with the first question? Of being under subsection 5, the allegation that she's incompetent to take care of these children, and yet no guardian ad litem was appointed?
I knew you were going there, so we might as well start with the weakness. 5 attorneys on this matter, one of which was on the advisory committee who rewrote the juvenile code. We all just missed it. I point blank tell you, we all just missed it. I don't know what more I can say.
Is that a fatal flaw?
Do I believe it's a fatal flaw? No, I do not.
Why not?
First of all, if you read some of the case law that is set forth under that statute, it states that a guardian ad litem would do probably two things. First of all, he would meet with the client, and after that meeting, either join with the state in the petition, or would write his own report, his or her own report, and then would, when he come to the termination, have an evaluation done, and if at all available, provide rebuttal evidence. Okay? First of all, Mr. Jay, counsel for the mother in this matter, was the one that requested the evaluation. The final evaluation prior to holding the hearing on the petition. Second of all,
was that a competency hearing, or was that...
There was a competency hearing prior to this evaluation that was conducted about a year. And the at that time, Dr. Ann Talbot found that she was competent to understand what was going on about her, and that she was also competent to understand that there were consequences. There were problems with her outburst in court, calling the judge and other counsel by specific names and telling them they had their heads in various places of their anatomy, et cetera, et cetera. So she was found to be competent and to understand the proceedings and know what was going on.
So when you chose to file it under subsection 5, doesn't that language say that the court shall appoint a guardian?
I will tell you straight up, Your Honor. Turn the page. There's 43292.01. I didn't turn the page. None of the attorneys in this matter turned the page. Mr. J. even missed it in his assignments of error to this court.
When you say she was found to be competent, I mean, was that... Is that in the record somewhere? I mean,
there's...
Go ahead. Excuse me. Go ahead.
I apologize.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
There are several exhibits in this matter that one of them is that competency evaluation.
Okay, and that does make a determination. Is this Talbot, or who makes that determination?
Dr. Ann Talbot made that determination. Dr. Lee Kimsey was the last... mental health professional to see her.
And is that the type of language they use, like that the person would, Crystal was able to understand what was going on in the proceedings, and words to that effect that we normally link to competency questions?
Yes.
And that is in our record.
That is in your record.
And that was determined that she was able to understand what was going on.
Yes.
Okay.
But you're...
And can you, excuse me, and can you point to where that is? There's an exhibit, or is it just in the...
I believe it's an exhibit. It was exhibit number... I can find my journal entry. 25, 26, 27, or 28. One of those exhibits.
Okay, thank you very much.
But as I understand it, that evaluation took place prior to your petition for termination.
Yes, it did.
And you raised the issue.
It actually took prior to my getting involved in the case also, because the case was... This case bounced from Cheyenne County, or from Keith County, Nebraska, to, I believe, Cheyenne County, Nebraska, and then to Dual County, Nebraska, where the children finally ended up residing. So, like I said, I did not turn the page. But I would hate to see that torpedo this termination from the standpoint of the best interest of the children. Let's address Mr. Jay's argument, if we may, regarding out-of-home placement. We can play semantics all we want here, and we can argue that this is no different than a dissolution case. It is different. In a dissolution case, you don't have the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services hovering over one parent or the other. You don't have them saying, okay, you can have visits here. You don't have a judicial proceeding every 3 or 6 months that says, well, Mom, you're doing okay, but we just can't get you there. Those children were out of mother's home from the inception of this proceeding. Never once were they left alone with her. The visits were supervised, and this leads into the reasonable efforts have failed. You can fault the department all you want in this case. They had one of the best family support workers involved in this case in our jurisdiction. And, yeah, she testified. She testified that in the two-year period she'd involved, nothing had improved to the point that those children could be left with the mother overnight until they were old enough to perhaps dial 911 or something like that, or basically take care of themselves. It couldn't be done. The mother in this matter just could not provide for these children. She had her own... Yes, Your Honor.
Excuse me, counsel. The problem I'm having to look to some degree is that the child is placed with the father or the stepfather. And all indications from what I've seen, everything's going smooth there. And there's probably... They're going to probably continue to be there from the record. Do you disagree with that?
Everything was going smooth with regard to the father's side. Now, I don't know how you want to define going smooth from the mother's aspect.
Well, the problem is that what we're dealing with then is not the custody. It's what we're concerned with is the visitation. I mean, that's the way it appears.
What happens when the department finally leaves and we have to go to the district court to determine custody? We do this all over again.
Does the juvenile court retain jurisdiction over that child and the placement of that child as long as the child remains within its jurisdiction?
As long as they remain within the confines of Health and Human Services. I may be incorrect in that, but that was always my assumption. And I'll be honest with this court, I did not research that. But... So
it's your position that once the department bows out, then that's going to take the court's authority away also?
No, it's my position, and I misunderstood the question. As long as that child is within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court,
right.
Yes, okay. I thought you meant the court is out and the department is out.
No.
Okay, I apologize.
Okay, well, but the court wouldn't have to continue to use the department and still retain jurisdiction.
No, that is correct.
So if the court retained jurisdiction and said, I'm placing these children with this particular individual and I'm only going to allow supervision or supervised visits with the mother, and if that any other type of visitation takes place, you're going to have to come back and report to me. Is that a less restrictive result than termination of the mother's rights? That would accomplish the same thing or not?
It is less restrictive, but I don't know if we would ever reach that point in this case.
Okay.
We've been here for 2 years. You can read the evaluations from Dr. Talbot and Dr. Kimsey. They both state that things have not improved to the point they could be left alone.
I'm not saying the custody would ever be back with the mother. I'm not disagreeing with you on that aspect at all. I'm just looking at whether... I mean, the children appear to be in a safe place. They appear to be with a parent or step-parent. And I'm not sure what we're accomplishing by terminating the parental rights of the mother.
We're giving these children permanency in their life. We're giving them the opportunity to not have someone always looking over mother's shoulder and the opportunity to not live in fear that they could be taken away from visits from their mother that way. They are still at a young age. They have bonded with their father and stepfather at this point. We have that. You know, both mental health professionals say that Crystal has a limited ability to improve to a level that she could assume parenting responsibilities. Dr. Kimsey said basically the same thing. We are at a point where the best interests of these children require that the mother's parental rights be terminated. With respect to the 43292.01 issue, I would submit to this court, yes, it's plain error, but nothing more could have been done. Her due process rights were not obliterated in this matter. They were not harmed. Everything was done. I realize that this case is a plain error. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. J have left? Mr. J?
Thanks. I would like to respond to something that Mr. Pollack has said along your line of questioning about he made a reference to having to go to the district court to get some sort of custody order. I think that we've had that problem for a long time. A couple years ago, we haven't addressed it, I don't believe at all, in my jurisdiction, but our county court, our juvenile court, can make that custody determination. We have to have a full-blown custody hearing. But like you said, custody is not an issue. But the judge could have made a permanent order from that point. Our judge in this case could have, and that would have held out there, and it could have regulated what sort of visitations they're supposed to be. And if there's some sort of reasonable alternative to terminating parental rights, then that's what we're supposed to do, because you saw the testimony of the family support worker, and I'll agree. She does a great job where we're at, and she really works with people and tries to get them on track. And with all the time that she spent with them, and it was a lot, she said there was a very strong bond between these kids and their mother. And so I don't know how it's in their best interest to go ahead and terminate when...
Well, in our situation, we have the father of one child, and we have he's the stepfather of the other, so he really doesn't have any parental rights as to the second child, does he?
He doesn't yet, but there was a relinquishment by the biological. I'm not sure if that's in the record. The stepchild was a child produced through an alleged sexual assault.
But he hasn't adopted that child.
Not at this time.
And so, I mean, aren't the two children really in a different position under your argument? I mean, the one child is with his biological father. He's with his parent. But the other child is just with someone who they have placed there. I mean, technically, I mean, it's still the stepfather. Somebody may know. But.
Technically, it would be, but it still doesn't mean we have to have a termination of the mother's right. If we wait and follow through, and there was an adoption, there's every indication that he will adopt this, then why did we have to have a termination of the mother's rights?
And we'd have to have something done with the mother's rights in order to have the child be able to be adopted, wouldn't you?
Well, the mother sent to the adoption of the stepfather. They had lived together, but the mother doesn't have. You could still have the adoption. I mean, you have step-parent adoptions all the time.
Well, I know, but they're not living together as husband and wife. I mean,
that's true.
It's not the normal situation where you have...
It's definitely not the normal situation.
Okay. Questions?
Still possible.
No, thanks.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming in. Both are excused.
Thank you.
Submitted.